This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in this week for Terry Gross. The gang wars and drug violence that have afflicted some urban communities have taken a frightful toll, but this isn't the first time American cities have seen such violence. Writer Jonathan Eig's new book takes us back to the Roaring Twenties in Chicago, when cops and judges were on the take and unsolved murders piled up by the dozens every year. Eig's new book chronicles the rise and fall of legendary gangster Al Capone. It's based on newly acquired documents and interviews with some of Capone's descendants. There's a lot you probably didn't know about Capone, like how freely he spoke to reporters of his exploits, the time he shot himself in the groin, how little Elliot Ness actually had to do with putting him away, and how venereal disease eventually robbed him of his health and sanity. Jonathan Eig is a former writer and editor for The Wall Street Journal, who's written bestsellers about Lou Gehrig and Jackie Robinson. He lives in Chicago, a half a mile from the site of the 1929 St. Valentine's Day Massacre. His new book is called Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. Jonathan Eig, welcome to Fresh Air. Al Capone comes to Chicago from New York in the early 20s. Give us a sense of the Chicago he arrived in.
It's a wild town. It's a rip-roaring town by almost any stretch of the imagination. And Chicago, for many, many years, has been a fairly lawless town, a place where the police have a hard time keeping up with the bad guys just because they are so horribly outnumbered. But by the 1920s, 1920 in particular, when Prohibition becomes the law, the city gets a lot crazier, and the prohibition really just amplifies everything, and it makes incredible opportunities available to men like Capone who are willing to continue breaking the law. Suddenly, there's a lot more money to be made than they ever dreamed possible.
And who was Capone? Tell us a little bit about his life in New York and what drove him to Chicago.
Capone was born 1899 in Brooklyn, part of a big family, one of eight children. And he was married just before coming to Chicago. He was working as a bouncer in a bar in Coney Island, a place called the Harvard Inn. And it was not Ivy League at all. It was a very tough place. And that's where he met a lot of the underworld figures who would become really key to his career going forward. And once he got to Chicago, he was able to really grow in terms of his stature, in terms of his prominence. I suspect if he'd stayed in New York, he would have remained a small-time guy. There was just too much competition for mugs like him. But Chicago was a different story. Chicago, he was fortunate to latch on with a good organization where he really learned and was able to move through the ranks quickly and became the man that we know today, the ultimate symbol of the 1920s, lawlessness, the ultimate gangster.
Talking a little bit about what was going on in Chicago and reading the book, I'm really struck by the level of violence, including political violence, battles over alderman elections.
That's right. You had candidates for aldermen throwing bombs through each other's windows, or at least using their representatives, their campaign workers, to do some of this violence. You had gangsters shooting each other over turf, over beer sales, and on an average of about 50 to 75 a year. And there were no convictions. That was really the key, and that's why this violence was allowed to flourish. There were very few arrests and literally no convictions in these gang wars throughout the 1920s. And that's because the whole system had been purchased at a great discount by these gangsters. They were able to bribe everyone in sight so that the law simply wasn't functioning. And that made almost anything possible for these guys.
I'm interested in how violent a man Capone himself was. Clearly, he spent a lot of his career directing others. But there is a murder that you describe of a man named Joe Howard. Tell us what we know about that murder and what we know about Capone's role.
I think early in his career, Capone was a violent man and did carry out many of these hits himself. And in this case, this is really the murder that put him on the map and I think signaled to the gang in Chicago that Capone was a man they could count on when the going got tough. So what happened was one of Capone's men, an accountant, got picked on in a bar by Joe Howard. And Joe Howard was one of Capone's rivals, but he was a two-bit thug, really. Capone didn't know much of him. But you didn't go after Capone's men, and that was the point. So in broad daylight, with one of his bodyguards, Capone walks right up to Joe Howard, says hello, puts the gun to his cheek, fires six times, and holds him on the bar stool as he keeps firing so that Joe Howard cannot get away, cannot fall even. When he's finally sure that Howard's been completely obliterated, he lets go, watches him fall to the floor. Everybody in the bar watches Capone walk out. And this is amazing because you've got the police swarming the place, and they know that it's Capone. They've got eyewitnesses saying, we know it was Capone. People saw him come in and out, but suddenly no one will testify because nobody wants to be on the wrong side of Al Capone. Nobody wants Capone to be the coming after them next. So he walks away from this crime. He answers the police questions, and there's no arrest. There's no conviction. He walks away a free man, and that sort of cements his reputation in the city, at least among gangsters. And it's one of the first times that he gets his name prominently displayed in the newspapers in Chicago.
But by 1925, Capone is really the leading organized crime figure in Chicago, and he is, what, a man in his mid-20s, right?
That's right. He's 26 years old.
And tell us a little bit about what his business was.
Well, he's making a lot of money. It's all cash, and it's mostly in the beer and whiskey business. He's bringing the stuff in from many, many different sources. It's a very complicated business, and that's really the key to Capone's success. He's able to keep a lot of balls in the air. He's able to run bars, brothels, casinos. He's bringing in some booze from Canada. He's bringing in some booze from New York. He's bringing in some whiskey from Iowa. It's a very complicated arrangement with a lot of people who have to be paid off. A lot of police officers, judges, politicians all have to be bribed. There's a lot of overhead involved. There's it's a complicated business. Now, I don't think Capone is taking in every penny from this operation. I think he's wise enough to share it with the people who he needs to keep happy in order to maintain such a complicated organization. But nevertheless, the amount of money coming in is staggering. By the government estimates, it's millions of dollars a year, which I think was probably exaggerated as the government later tried to build a case against him for income tax evasion. But I'm certain at the very least Capone was dealing in hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash every year. And for a young man in his 20s with not much education, a sixth grade education, and not much really in the way of school smarts, he does a terrific job really running this organization, and I think that's really the key to his success is his charisma, his sort of intuition as a businessman. It carries him a long way. That, of course, and the threat of violence.
Now, you also write in this book that the Tommy gun changed the nature of crime. How?
Well, the Thompson submachine gun was invented during World War I. It was meant to put an end to World War I, but it arrived too late. So the general who designed the gun looked for other outlets, tried to sell it to police departments, but police departments didn't have the budget and weren't really sure what to do with such a powerful weapon. Enter the gangster who can easily purchase the machine gun in a sporting goods catalog or at a local gun shop. And there happened to be one just a couple blocks from where I live now in Chicago, a place where you could walk in and buy a machine gun if you had the cash. And this became the weapon of choice for the gangster because they could shoot on the run. They could shoot from their car windows and fire hundreds of rounds within seconds. This, along with fast automobiles, really gave the gangsters an advantage over the police because the cops had slower, older cars. They had much lighter weapons, and this enabled them to commit their crimes and escape as if bribing the police officers wasn't already enough of an advantage for these guys.
You know, mob hits are in some ways sort of a part of life in many cities at many particular times, and citizens don't worry so much about them because, it's gangsters settling scores with one another. It seems a little different if you have a car driving up and a submachine gun splattering bullets all over a sidewalk. Did Chicago's population feel terrorized?
You know, I think at times Chicago's population felt terrorized, but it wasn't so much the machine guns that did it. I think because there really was very little collateral damage. There were hardly any incidents in which innocent civilians were killed in these gang wars. It was really the gangsters being killed, and I think given that the police weren't doing anything to stop these guys, the fact that some of them died didn't stir a lot of sympathy among most Chicagoans. The real issue, I think, for most Chicagoans was the damage it did to the city's reputation. We already had an image of corrupt politics. We had a mayor who was widely perceived as being one of the most venal in the city in the country's history, Big Bill Thompson. And then you've got these gangsters walking down the street with machine guns, shooting it out on Michigan Avenue in broad daylight. And this is, as you can imagine, not good for business. So the city's business leaders are really the first ones who start to raise a ruckus and say something must be done about this.
You know, one of the things that made Capone unique was his public profile, and that's something that he fed in ways that modern gangsters I just don't think did. I mean, it's remarkable to read some of the quotes in your book that he gave newspaper reporters. And I thought, you know, just for a little flavor here, I thought we would listen to Robert De Niro as Al Capone in the movie The Untouchables. This is a moment where I think he's getting a shave and having an exchange with some reporters. Let's listen.
An article which I believe appeared in a newspaper asked why, since you are, or it would seem that you are in effect the mayor of Chicago, you've not simply been appointed to that position.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's touching. Like a lot of things in life, we laugh because it's funny and we laugh because it's true. Some people say, reformers here say, put that man in jail. What does he think he is doing? What I hope I'm doing, and here's where your English paper's got a point, is I'm responding to the will of the people. People are going to drink. You know that. I know that. We all know that. And all I do is act on that. And all this talk of bootlegging. What is bootlegging? On the boat, it's bootlegging. On Lakeshore Drive, it's hospitality. I'm a businessman.
And what of your reputation that you control your business through violence, that those that don't purchase your products are dealt with violently?
I grew up in a tough neighborhood, and we used to say you can get further with a kind word and a gun than you can with just a kind word. And in that neighborhood, it might have been true. And sometimes a reputation follows you. There is violence in Chicago, of course, but not by me and not by anybody I employ. And I'll tell you why, because it's not good business.
And that is the fictional Al Capone, portrayed by Robert De Niro in the movie The Untouchables. We're speaking with Jonathan Eig, who has written a new book about Al Capone called Get Capone. Jonathan Eig, how close is that to the real thing?
It was pretty close, actually, because Capone did talk to the reporters a lot, and he always defended himself as a businessman. He always said, people want a drink, and all I'm doing is giving them the pleasures that they desire. The irony is that De Niro actually understated Capone's tolerance for violence, because in interviews, Capone would often say violence was part of the job, but he didn't see it necessarily as something God would consider a sin, because he was protecting himself. He was protecting his family. He was protecting the business that he needed in order to take care of his family. And maybe he had a broader view of this thing than the law has it. That's how he explained it. But he did acknowledge that he was a bootlegger. He acknowledged that sometimes violence was necessary in order to do his job.
How did his associates at organized crime feel about him being such a media hog? I can't imagine they thought this was a good idea.
No, it didn't go over very well with his peers. Now, you have to remember that in the 1920s, everybody wanted to be a celebrity. Everybody wanted to be like Babe Ruth or Lucky Lindbergh, or at least, you know, like these guys who were sitting on flagpoles. And businessmen in particular in the 20s really believed that to be a success, to be an entrepreneur, meant to have a personality, to cultivate a sense that you were a success. That's why I think Capone dressed the way he did. And that's why I think he entertained the press, because he wanted to be perceived as a successful American. It's, you know, sort of Dale Carnegie later, when he wrote his famous book on success in business, would cite Capone actually as a model for creating the public image. Obviously, it went bad in many ways with Capone. But nevertheless, that's what he was going for. And I think that you have to understand that cult of celebrity and that desire for the spotlight that really was so strong during the 1920s.
On the other hand, he clearly cared about his public image. How did the public feel about Al Capone?
I'd say the feelings were mixed. Clearly, Capone was a villain, and clearly he was a criminal. And the fact that he discussed his criminality didn't absolve him of those crimes in any way. At the same time, he was breaking a law that was wildly unpopular. Prohibition was a mistake by almost any definition, and by the 1920s, when the war was over and people were coming out of this these hard times and looking to celebrate, and the economy was booming, it was really just was a terrible fit. And Capone became really the symbol of that era in many ways. And certainly, when it came to people's willingness to break that law, Capone became a very powerful icon. And he stood up for a lot of people who were willing to say they didn't like it. So he becomes the icon for the 20s because everyone is breaking this law, and he's just breaking it in a much bigger way than anyone else.
Now, he had a house on Chicago's south side where his family lived, his wife and other relatives, and he spent a lot of time kind of occupying a suite in downtown hotels. Was he seen on the street? Did the public come up to him and fawn over him and seek autographs or photos?
Yes, Capone really was a very public person, and he went to ball games. He attended opera. He was seen around town, and it became a joke, really, among tourists when they visited Chicago. You know, when you came back from your trip, people would say, "Did you see Capone? Did you get any pictures of Capone? Do you have any bullet holes in your car?" And some of it was a joke, but much of it was actually inspired by the fact that Capone was seen around town. There were pictures of him in the newspaper when he went to the races. He did not sneak about. He felt like he was a businessman, and he wanted to be seen that way.
And, you know, we haven't talked about what he looked like, but just give us a sense of the physical presence he struck.
Capone was a big man. You know, he was 5'10", 210 pounds roughly in his prime. He got a little heavier late in his career. But I think that was the key to his early success, is that he was big enough and strong enough to scare people when he stood over them in a bar. But he always wanted to be perceived more elegantly, and he liked, actually, you know, his nickname was Scarface, of course, in the newspapers because of the three hideous scars on the left side of his cheek. But the nickname he preferred was Snorky, which at the time meant elegant, ritzy. And he dressed in an incredibly fashionable ways with gleaming diamond belt buckles, but also, you know, very tasteful three-piece suits. It was a real mix of elegance and show, and I think that that's how he preferred to be perceived, and that was very important. So you had this big hulking guy who wanted to dress like Fred Astaire. He wanted to be seen as a symbol of wealth and elegance.
You know, eventually, gangsters like Capone appeared in the movies, and I guess it was in 1931 that the film Little Caesar was made, which did not have a character named Capone, but Edward G. Robinson played a guy named Rico Bandello, right?
That's right.
I thought we'd hear just a little bit of this. This is a moment in the film where he's basically ousting one of the local crime bosses, taken over from a guy whose character's name is Sam Vitone. He's played by Stan Lee Fields. Let's listen.
Now let's see the color of that money.
Yeah, just a minute, Sam. I got my own ideas of a split this time. And you can take it my way or leave it. We ain't begging you.
Yeah? Well, I bossed this job. And I'm going to get my split in the regular way or else.
Well, how'd you boss this job? By sitting here in your office cheating yourself a solitaire? Well, that don't go no more. Not with me, I don't. We're done. I've been taking orders from you too long.
Yeah, and you'll keep on taking orders, too. Or you'll get out of here so fast.
Yeah, well, maybe it won't be me that gets out.
No?
Yeah.
Well, maybe the boys have got something to say about that. What about it? So, that's it, huh?
Yeah. That's it, all right. Sam, you can dish it out, but you're getting so you can't take it no more. You're through.
And that's Edward G. Robinson from the film Little Caesar from 1931. Jonathan, I, you know, it's interesting that Al Capone was such a public figure in his day. Do we know if actors like Robinson or Cagney actually drew their performances from Capone?
We think that they did. And, you know, these movies were made while Capone was still in operation. That's the amazing thing. While, even before Capone went to jail. Before he was convicted by the federal government, these movies and books were in the works. And some reports say that Edward G. Robinson attended the Capone trial to sort of get a sense for Capone's body language and his mannerisms. I think there's more Edward G. Robinson than Capone in Rico Bandello. But it's clear that many of the elements of these characters in the movies were based on Capone. And it's fascinating to think that even in his lifetime, even before he goes sent away to federal prison, that he's watching these books and movies emerge based on his life story. And I think what fascinated the American public was not just the violence, but the fact that these were immigrant stories. And if you watch these movies today, really that's the key to their drama, to their psychological power. It's the fact that these are, you know, Horatio Alger stories in many ways. These are immigrants or immigrants' children trying to make it in this country and finding a way that may not be the best way and is a dark, evil way in many ways, but nevertheless, it's their way of getting up in this and getting a step up in this country.
Did these films affect the public perception of Capone?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I think this is what cemented the public perception of Capone and really began to turn it from a human being, which, you know, Capone was. Capone was really not the psychopath that he was eventually made to be in the movies. He was not this killing machine. He was, a product of his times and a product of prohibition. And his rise to power is certainly attributable to his violence, but it's also attributable to his ambition. But I think these movies really began to turn the picture into something much more stereotypical.
It's interesting to read the story of his cat and mouse battle with law enforcement. And there's a period of years where he seems to be practically openly running this huge bootlegging and gambling and prostitution operation, and probably connected to multiple murders. Authorities can't seem to get him on anything, but he's so harassed that he eventually flees Chicago for long periods, tries to set up in L.A., that doesn't work, ends up in Miami. What was going on?
Well, it really was harassment. When the police came after him, ultimately he got away each time. They might charge him with some small crime and he'd spend a night or two in jail, but he would bribe his way out every time, and the justice system just wasn't capable of putting him away for any stretch. The irony is that he paid a brief visit to Philadelphia and got picked up there for possession of a handgun and was jailed for a year in Philadelphia after a decade in which the Chicago judicial system was incapable of doing anything with the guy. But finally, by the late 1920s, he does start to feel like the harassment is getting to be too much, and he sort of flits about from Los Angeles back to Chicago, Chicago down to Miami, Miami back to Chicago, really getting harassed everywhere he goes. And this is by now is when the net is beginning to tighten on him, and the federal government is really getting involved, and there are FBI agents following him everywhere. There are wiretaps on his phones, prohibition agents keeping an eye on him and trying to shut down his operation and limit his cash flow. And the Chicago police are still fairly ineffective at this point, but there are enough forces coming after Capone by now that he's starting to really feel the pressure.
Right. And one thing that stepped up the pressure was the events of St. Valentine's Day, 1929. What happened?
That was a huge moment for Al Capone. This is, of course, the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Everybody knows this as one of the most famous unsolved crimes in American history. 7 men in a parking garage on the north side of Chicago, most of them members of the Bugs Moran gang. And they are accosted by 3 or 4 men, 2 of them wearing police uniforms. They're lined up against the wall and gunned down with machine guns and shotguns. And everybody assumes at first that it must have been Capone who did this because these were rival gang members. But there are many competing theories, including that it may have been done by a gang from Detroit, a gang from St. Louis. Some people say it may have been the cops who did it. And over time, these theories just come and go. And Capone was not in town at the time. Given how much pressure he was under from the federal government, I find it hard to believe that he would have been so daring to go after the Bugs Moran gang in this way, and then also not to get Bugs Moran, the leader of the gang, wasn't in the garage that day. So to me, it doesn't have the hallmarks of an Al Capone crime. But nevertheless, it becomes just associated with him, and this puts more pressure than ever on the federal government to do something about this man.
Right. And so you've got the federal government. The president, Herbert Hoover, is making a big issue of the lawlessness in the cities, and he's pressuring the IRS and the then brand new the predecessor, really, of the FBI, right? Everyone is trying to find a way to get Capone. And one of the things that's interesting is the role of Chicago business leaders. I mean, there are people who obviously, who corporate and civic leaders who have some interest in reform in the town. What assistance, if any, did they give to authorities in putting Capone away?
The Chicago business community was a great help, first of all, in getting the federal government off its back, getting them to do something about this, because the business leaders were tired of this man destroying the city's image, and they went to Washington. They met with Herbert Hoover almost immediately after his inauguration and said that we need your help, that we can't count on the local police, the local courts to do anything about this. And Herbert Hoover responded. He was really the perfect man for this at the time because he came to office promising to clean up America's broken justice system and promising to enforce the laws of prohibition. And he really made this a priority of his administration. Of course, this is before the Depression hits. And right now, if you look at the spring of 1929, the economy is booming, the stock market's going up and up, and Hoover can really gain a lot of points by going after these criminals. So he makes this a priority, and he orders his administration not only to reform the justice system but to go after Capone, to make a symbol of this man. He understands the public relations value in taking out the man that Chicago business leaders have dubbed public enemy number one. And that's really a phrase that the marketing team in Chicago has come up with to try to put more pressure on the government to come after Capone.
Right. And there are various points in the story at which the business leaders will do things like come up with money to relocate a witness who might be willing to give in the government evidence against Capone.
That's right. Chicago's business community did things that the government couldn't do, things that were either unethical or that the federal government just didn't have the money for. There was no such thing as a witness protection program at the time. So these men would take witnesses who were willing to testify against Capone and ship them off to South America for some months so that Capone couldn't find them. They were willing to fund ballistics experts to come in and do work on some of the guns and some of the bullets recovered after the Valentine's Day massacre. So they were really pushing this thing forward, and it was a really interesting mix of private and public officials going to battle against Al Capone.
Now, in the legend as it has come down, it's Elliot Ness that was leading the charge against Al Capone. And I couldn't resist playing a little bit of the opening of The Untouchables, the TV series in which Elliot Ness is played by Robert Stack. This is the opening to the show with Walter Winchell narrating.
In the last weeks of March 1931, Elliot Ness and his Untouchables were hitting hard at the Capone Empire. Every day, gunshots rattled the concrete as Ness led his men in raid after raid. While prosperity stayed around the corner for most of us, it came out and licked the hands of mobsters, bootleggers, and hoods. For them, it had been Rome at its height, under Emperor Al Capone, until Elliot Ness moved in to clean up.
And that's from the TV series The Untouchables. Jonathan Eig, you tell us that the Elliot Ness story contains a fair amount of mythology. How did he get to be the legendary crusader against Al Capone?
Ness was a prohibition agent during the 20s. He got the job because of nepotism. He was really not qualified for it particularly, and he wasn't very good at it either. Early in his career, he did some undercover work that just ended disastrously, and he was completely easily identified by these gangsters, and he was never able to go undercover again. So he spent his years in the Capone case really just as a sort of a nuisance to Al Capone, busting down doors and breweries, breaking up distilleries, and trying to disrupt Capone's cash flow. He never came up with any evidence that was useful to the prosecutors who were trying to build their case against Scarface Capone. And as a result of that, I think Capone really had very little to do with Elliot Ness. I don't even know if he knew that Elliot Ness existed, to be honest. He was much more concerned with the lawyers who were building this case, and he was much more concerned with the Revenue Bureau agents, the tax men, who were coming after him about his income taxes. These were the real pressures that were making Al Capone sweat. Elliot Ness really only became famous later, at the end of his career. He after Chicago, he went to work as a public servant in Cleveland. His career did not end well. He ran for mayor and lost. He had some problems with the law himself, a drunk driving case, some affairs with women that became public. But he was fortunate enough to run into a man who rewrote his story for him. And this ghost-written story of Elliot Ness became a very successful book and was turned into the TV show and then, of course, the movie later with Kevin Costner. But these stories were really only very, very loosely based on the truth. And Elliot Ness was the beneficiary, really, of just a great marketing team that went to work for him late in his life. And he never actually lived to see the fame that would come his way.
So who were the key figures in taking Al Capone down?
Well, after Herbert Hoover, Hoover really is the man, the engineer who's making all this happen. But the key person in Chicago is someone your listeners have probably never heard of, and that's George E.Q. Johnson. He was the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. And I was fortunate in my research to find his personal papers, to find all of his government work papers. None of this had been cataloged. None of it was in the National Archives where it should have been. And what this stuff showed, I mean, this were thousands of pages of government memos on the Capone case, transcripts of wiretaps. It showed that he was really a very nervous man who had a very weak case against Capone, and he was afraid to bring it to trial, in fact, and really had to do so only after getting sort of kicked in the tail by President Hoover and his top men in the Justice Department, wondering why it was taking so long to put together any kind of a case against Al Capone.
Right. Now, and it was tricky because although clearly Al Capone had a lot of money and spent a lot of money. There weren't really records that show he got any money from his illegal activities. They did put together some witnesses and put together a case and indict him, but it had some holes, right?
Yes, the case against Capone had a lot of holes, and the federal government knew it. First of all, they were dealing almost entirely with circumstantial evidence. They had no proof of income. They were not able to find any checks. They were not able to find any bank accounts. They really could find very little property with Capone's name on it. So they built this case basically on his expenses. They showed the court, they showed the jury that he was a lavish spender, and they asked the jury to believe that if he was spending lavishly, he must have been getting the money from somewhere. But in fact, there was no way to really tie Capone to this bootlegging business, except for the fact that he went around telling everybody that he was a bootlegger.
Right, and he had attorneys who at times approached the government and said, look, we want to make a deal. We want to settle our tax debt. And in fact, one of the memos that they gave on that one of the attorneys gave to the government on Capone's behalf was then used against him to show, aha, see, he does have all this illegitimate income, right?
That's right. And this is one of the very suspect moments in the Capone trial. They take this letter that was written in an attempt to settle the case, and they say, okay, here's what we'll agree to. If you're willing to make a deal, we'll agree to pay this much money, and we'll theoretically say that Capone had $100,000 of income this year and $100,000 that year and $90,000 the following year. The government says, well, thanks very much. We don't accept your offer, but we will use this letter to prove that Capone had income in those years. That probably should have been thrown out, should not have been admissible in court, but Capone's lawyers were not able to stop it from being entered into the record.
And the fascinating thing is, as I read the development of this, I mean, everybody wanted to get Al Capone. They had this somewhat shaky indictment on tax evasion, and the government, including George E.Q. Johnson, the U.S. attorney, agreed to a deal in which Capone was going to plead guilty and get, 2.5 years? Is that right?
That's right, 2.5 years.
And the judge refused to approve it. What happened?
This is one of the most intriguing moments, and these documents that I discovered in the George Johnson files really went into this in great detail because Johnson thought he had a deal. Capone's lawyers thought they had a deal. Everybody up to the U.S. Attorney General had signed off on this deal, and the judge himself had told the U.S. Attorney that he would go along with this. And then they walk into court, Capone enters his plea of guilty, and the judge says, I'm taking it off the table. I do not accept. And he insists on a trial.
And why did he do that?
Well, that's the really interesting question. Some people think that it may have been because the judge was irate, that Capone had already been going around bragging to his pals at the newspapers that he was going to get 2.5 years, and he could do 2.5 years standing on his head. He'd be out. He'd only be 33, 34 years old. He'd be back in business. But there's also a school of thought that says that Herbert Hoover himself, the president, intervened here and may have sent one of his emissaries to visit the judge the night before Capone entered his guilty plea and insisted that the judge should take this to trial, that the president was not happy with the 2.5-year plea bargain.
And in the end, he is convicted by not every charge but enough so that the judge puts him away for 11 years. What was his reaction?
He was stunned. Nobody saw this coming, especially after he was thinking, we're talking 2.5, 3 years based on what kind of an offer the government had made and based on other income tax cases. He'd already seen some of his gang members go to jail for income tax evasion. He'd seen his brother convicted, and the typical sentence was 2-3 years. So he was not prepared at all for this. And one of the keys really is that Capone was not tried by a jury of his peers. The jury was really hand-chosen, specially selected by this judge. And they were not only – it was difficult in the 20s to find men who were willing to convict bootleggers because everybody drank. But this was a jury that was not only willing to convict, it was eager to convict. And to say they threw the book at Capone is a massive understatement.
And then he's sentenced to serve time in Atlanta. And there's this train trip where the marshals are escorting him from Chicago to Atlanta. And this is hard to believe, but he actually has sort of mini press conferences at every whistle stop?
Yeah, you've got hundreds of people lining the railroads, lining the train tracks to see this guy. It's kind of reminded me of Babe Ruth every year when he would go down to spring training, and you'd have people just gathered at the train station, sometimes just hoping to see the train, even if not to see the man himself. But Capone would stop at every train station and get out and wave to his adoring public, and he would give press releases, and he was dressed immaculately. There was no prison attire for this guy. He was allowed allowed to play cards on the train with the U.S. Marshals who were escorting him down there. You know, he was conferred celebrity status, and it's amazing to me that the government let him get away with it, but he loved every minute of it.
So when Al Capone is sentenced to 11 years in prison in 1931, he's still a young man. And, you know, he might have gotten out in 10 with good behavior and resumed his career. But he didn't. What became of him in prison?
When Capone got to the penitentiary in Atlanta, they ran a series of standard tests. They interviewed him about his life. They took an IQ test, found that he had a 95 IQ. They completed a very detailed record of his life and his health. And in doing the health examination, they found that he had tertiary syphilis, which meant that it was already affecting his nervous system and affecting his brain. And he told the doctors that he had first noticed the symptoms of syphilis when he was a very young man at about 19 or 20 and had ignored them and not treated them. Had he treated them at that point, he probably would have made a complete recovery. There was a very good treatment at the time. But in letting it go, the disease spread, and by then it was affecting his neurological system, and there was no turning back. There was nothing anyone could do about it at that point. And as a result of that, his remaining years would be brutal, really. His mind began to melt away. He would enjoy some moments of clarity and some moments where he was capable of writing letters to his family and visiting with them in peace. But there were also times when he suffered seizures, when he was delusional, and by the end, as one of his fellow gang members put it, he was nutty as a fruitcake.
Did some time at Alcatraz, which was new, but eventually was released and died in 1947. Never was an active criminal again, as far as we know?
No, he really was not capable of it, even if he had wanted to get back into the life.
And he lived in Miami, right, with his wife, May, and his son, Sonny, is that right? Was there enough money left over from the enterprise to make them comfortable?
I think the family lived comfortably in those last years. And I think the outfit, as it continued on without him, obviously Prohibition came to an end and they found other ways of making their money. I think the outfit continued to take care of Capone and his family members. I think they would receive regular supplies of cash for whatever they needed. But once Capone died, those envelopes stopped coming and the family had to fend for itself. And there was never any great treasure chest discovered. A lot of Capone family members thought that Capone must have hidden the money away somewhere. And in those late years when his mind was going and he really behaved in a childlike way, they would ask him again and again, you know, where did you put the money? Where is it? And it's possible he spent it all, but he always said that he couldn't remember. If he'd hid it any away, he couldn't remember where it was.
And irony of ironies, he never paid the tax debt that sent him to prison.
That is true. He died owing the government all this money. They never seized the house in Florida. They never seized his mother's house in Chicago. But they took every other asset they could find, and he still left quite a considerable debt.
Well, Jonathan Eich, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Eich's book is called Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. You can read an excerpt at our website, freshair.npr.org. Long before there was Lisbeth Salander, the heroine of Stieg Larsson's phenomenally successful Millennium series, there was Martin Beck, another loner Swedish detective who investigated the bigger mysteries haunting the society of his time. Book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the utopian social fantasies offered up by both the Millennium series and its 1960s-era forerunner.
For the past few months, whenever I've found myself in a public space, in a Starbucks or doctor's waiting room, I always see somebody reading one of the novels in the Millennium series by Stieg Larsson. As a phenomenon, it's truly incredible. Millions upon millions of people in the U.S. alone, men and women, are captivated by a mystery series built around a main character who's an antisocial, bisexual, feminist, cyber genius Avenger. Oh, and she's Swedish. Not since the arrival of IKEA on these shores has Sweden made such an inroad into the American home and imagination. As far as mystery fiction goes, though, Larsson is the tippy top of a Nordic literary iceberg that's been moving inexorably into our waters over the past few decades. Before the girl with the dragon tattoo landed in this country in 2008, Henning Mankell was the mystery writer that everybody was raving about. Mankell's fellow Swedes, Helene Tursten, who writes very good police procedurals, and Kirsten Ekman, whose novel Blackwater was a standout, also made their mark. So have Karen Fossum and Joe Nesbo from Norway, and the late crime master Jan William van der Vettering from Holland. If the years between the world wars were the golden age of British mystery, we've surely entered a new ice age. When I first read Stieg Larsson and heard his novels talked about as composing a multi-novel epic about contemporary Swedish society, a little chime went off in my head. I thought of an extraordinary pair of older Swedish mystery writers I haven't yet mentioned, Maj Sjöwall and Per Wallu. To anyone who loves crime fiction, Sjöwall and Wallu are immortals. Their Chief Inspector Martin Beck novels are still in print and still read, though their popularity has never approached anything like Larsson's. Sjöwall and Wallu were married and together dreamt up the idea of writing 10 novels of 30 chapters each, composing an epic that spanned 10 years, from 1965 to 1975. Their aim, like Larsson's, was to investigate society. In their own words, Sjöwall and Wallu said that they wanted to use detective fiction to wield a scalpel to lay open the soft belly of the morally debatable bourgeois welfare state, exposing the cancer that was eating away at Swedish society. At night, after they put their children to bed, Sjöwall and Wallu would sit down at a table together, facing each other. And from detailed outlines, they would simultaneously write alternate chapters of whatever Martin Beck novel they were then working on. To me, this sounds like a marital recipe for homicide, but it worked for Sjöwall and Wallu, and they wrote brilliant stories, among them The Fire Engine That Disappeared and The Laughing Policeman, about the growing violence in Swedish society and the upsurge in militant demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. To read the collective work of Sjöwall and Wallu and Larsson is to have the dizzying illusion of reading one smart, entertaining, multi-volume work of social criticism focused on Sweden with pointed applications to America as well. But there's more. Great detective fiction doesn't only offer social criticism. It also contains utopian alternatives to a world gone wrong. For Sjöwall and Wallu, that utopian alternative, circa 1975, involved a recommitment to the ideals of social democracy. In the last scene of the last novel, The Terrorists, Martin Beck and one of his close colleagues are setting up a game of Scrabble. The colleague, who's quit the police in frustration, tells Beck that, "The trouble with you, Martin, is just that you've got the wrong job, at the wrong time, in the wrong part of the world, in the wrong system." Then he turns over his Scrabble square and says, "My turn to start? Then I say X. X. As in Marx." Compare that class-based solution to society's ills to the dream vision that Larsson gives us. By the end of the Millennium series, a much more ragtag community of characters has come together, their very existence made possible by feminism and by the gay liberation movement. In uneasy alliance, they temporarily conquer the forces of cannibalistic capitalism, sexism, and international worker abuse. Such is the utopian dream that has infiltrated the psyches of the American reading public, blue stater and red stater. The astounding popularity of Larsson's Millennium series is a testament to the undercover power of popular literature to transport us readers out of our hemmed-in worldviews.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.